Hello and welcome back, or welcome to the Gestalt Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler White. This interview today was a good one. So we sat down and chatted with Will Carroll. So you may have seen or heard or read Will's work on Sports Illustrated, ESPN, Baseball Prospectus, Bleacher Report, MLB Network. There's a whole bunch of them. He's all over the place. So normally you hear or see or read Will in 10 to 15 minute spurts. Today we're going to actually sit down a little bit longer form interview and really break down who Will is. So this interview was awesome. I'm excited to bring it to everybody and for you all to listen. A little bit different, a different approach today, having a sports writer and not someone that's in the strength and conditioning or the rehab. Well, he's the injury expert, but more of like the hands-on, you know, he brings a different perspective to it. So it's this one went really well. So without further ado, please enjoy Will Carroll. Will.
Hey, how's it going, Tyler?
Welcome. How we doing?
Well, you know, as good as can be done. You know, we've been a month in quarantine, which for me is, you know, Tuesday. I've been working from home for 20 years, so this isn't that unusual for me. It's just a little more enforced, a few less trips out. It's more the not being able to. You know, there are a lot of times where I say, you know, do I want to go out? Do I want to run to the store? Do I want to go see somebody? And you'll come up with excuses. And now that you theoretically can't, you know, it feels like somebody's taken something away from me, even though it really hasn't made a significant change in my life. I know for people out there, talking to doctors, talking to frontline people, a friend of mine works in a grocery store and you know, talking about how they've got to get masks to her workers. And you know, it's kind of crazy how this has shown us this whole word essential is kind of crazy. If you'd asked who was an essential worker 2 months ago, I think our answer would have been significantly different. We would have said doctors and firemen. And now, you know, grocery store workers and the Amazon delivery guy are as essential as police and fire, I think.
It's, yeah, okay, that is a really interesting topic, because my buddy who actually lives over by you in Indianapolis, he worked for Verizon, and they're listed as essential, because you got to have cell phones, you got to have service, you got to be able to communicate. So it is wild, you know, like that's, we have to have them out there in the stores, like helping people stay connected. It is wild. But one thing that you said earlier, you know, not much has necessarily changed for you working from home. You write and talk on sports. There's no sports right now.
Yeah.
That's got to be driving you insane.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, again, I don't want to pretend I'm having some horrible bad thing. You know, I'm healthy. I'm still a couple levels removed from knowing anyone. You know, it's friend of friends. You go on Facebook and you see people who talk about their brother is sick. I've been lucky, at least in that regard. So, again, not complaining, but not having sports is, I mean, for me especially, but for the world, it's just different. What do you do when there's no sports? I always used to joke, you know, someday there's going to be a day without injuries. And then I've got plenty of other things I'd like to write about. Well, that's been the last month. And, you know, as I was launching my newsletter, I was ready for injuries. I was ready to talk about Tommy John surgeries and the changes and what we should be doing with rehabs and, you know, why we shouldn't be getting all these core muscle strains and why the heck are we calling it core muscle to begin with. And boom, we end up with nothing. The interesting thing, and this is something I'm sure we'll talk about later, is why are we not having any injuries right now? I guarantee you we are. I guarantee you there's some guy from Major League Baseball or the NBA who has twisted his ankle in his home gym. I watched about 10 minutes of that ESPN horse thing the other night, and it was horrible. I can go for hours on why that was bad.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh yeah, they had a horse competition with a bunch of people from the NBA and the WNBA, and there were a couple, you know, retired players just playing horse. But the thing looked like it was on, somebody was recording it on a flip phone. And it was just bad.
People
just
are bored. Wasn't
compelling TV. but I was waiting for somebody to do some trick shot and roll an ankle. And you know that somebody at home has been on a treadmill and strained a hamstring. You know that somebody has been playing hoops in their home gym and rolled an ankle. We're going to come back and we're going to be missing some players before we even get to the games and getting them back into shape where we're going to have a bunch of injuries.
Yeah, no, I will vouch for that. I do know that is occurring. I know there are some players that are hurt, that are getting hurt, you know, from training. And, you know, some of that is they are solely reliant upon themselves to do all of their training on their own, right? They can't be around trainers. They can't be around the sports medicine staff. No one is there to help them. They're kind of responsible for their own well-being and shape right now. So it's absolutely happening. But I would be shocked if anyone came out and let that be known to the world right now.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I haven't been trying to figure out who it is because, honestly, it doesn't really matter. There's so many more things going on. It'll matter when we get back. The questions that I have is, it's easier to address this in terms of the NFL draft. The NFL draft, they haven't had the chance to have people in. They haven't had pro days. They haven't had the private workouts. But does that really matter? I mean, Mike Mayock, who's now the GM of the, and how many times are we going to screw this up, the Las Vegas Raiders, he was on NFL Network for years and years doing what people are now doing to him, saying, you know, they ought to draft this, they ought to draft that, this is this guy. It was essentially virtual scouting, which is what they're doing now. Now, I don't think there's going to be that much difference. I mean, if you look at mock drafts from 2 months ago at the combine, when the world was essentially normal, and then look at who gets drafted, what really changed? Did some guy who gets picked in the seventh round, you know, not drop out because they didn't find something? Did somebody who didn't get drafted not move up because he didn't have a great workout or a great interview? I don't think it's really going to matter that much. I don't think we're going to look back 5 years from now and go, wow, that 2020 draft was a mess. I think we're going to go, 2020 draft was weird. But then again, why did we ever put the draft, you know, in the middle of a lake? But I think to take this back to baseball and the training situation that we have, I think we're going to figure out, A, which players take it seriously, which players don't, which teams take it seriously, because the athletic trainers, the physical therapists, the strength and conditioning guys, they're all in touch with these guys the way they are in the off season, checking in, how's things going. I've heard about players that, you know, need that motivation. So they got some guy on FaceTime yelling at them during a workout. Okay, I get it. You know, you've got the Eric Cressys and the Alan Jagers and the Ron Wolforth around, and they're still talking and training people, but it's just you're not standing there over them. So I think we're going to learn really quickly what teams have systems in place, not to specifically deal with this kind of thing, but to deal with people in a manner that, you know, essentially can devolve to a virtual situation. And I think the better teams that had systems in place and could communicate those are going to come out of this significantly better.
I agree. And going back to what you talked about with the draft, I think this is going to cut the fat out of a lot of situations, whether it's drafting, training, whatever. This whole situation is going to weed that out. It's going to say, hey, this was necessary, this was not. And it's going to completely change how we do a lot. A lot of things are going to change from this.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Sorry, I missed the mute button there. and I do think we're going to have to reassess things because if we think this is the last time we're going to be facing this kind of situation, it's as short-sighted as we were before this situation. We've got to be able to learn from this and say, how can we do this better? The other thing is, we've always had the off-season problem of how do you go out and do it? I know most players now have their own choice of they're going to Cressy or they're going to Exos or wherever. But I think teams are going to be able to be more virtual about it and get a better touch as well.
Yeah, I agree. I've talked to a few of my buddies that work in with different organizations, and you know they'll fill me in. You know, they'll say, "Hey, have you heard of this guy? You know what this guy's doing, how he's training." And they'll tell me there's some success with some guys that are, you know, we trust who he's working with here or where he's at over here. Mm-hmm. And then also you have the ones that are like, "Man, I can't believe that they're working with this organization. The stuff they're doing is insane. Doesn't make any sense." But they can't control that, right? I mean, right. And that's not really much different than what we're doing now, per se. But in the fact that, you know, before they kind of can do a little bit of like, hey, come in house, come work here, or come work out at the facility, and we'll monitor. You can do their stuff, but we're going to monitor it. Now they don't have that option. Now it's like you're at home. You're doing your own thing. We really can't say or do anything to stop you. We just have to hope you come to camp whenever camp does begin, that you're in decent shape and not worse off.
Yeah, which that has always bothered me. You know, the fact is you could do more with this, whether it's remote monitoring, whether it's sending people out. Those are available to you. The other thing is, you can't force someone at the major league level to go to a place you want them to go, or to stay at your own place with your own facilities and trainers and everything. But what you can do is incent them. And no team that I know of has done this. If you said, I want you to work out with Tyler, I want you out there in Missouri and saying, go for it all season long, and I'm going to give you $1,000 a month plus housing. There's going to be players that take that up. Not all of them, but, you know, in the same way that protective equipment. if I were an owner, I would have had in the NFL, I would say, I will get you any helmet you want, but – if you wear the best helmet, I'll give you an extra $1,000 a week. There is nothing in the rules that say you can't incent people to do things. It just says you can't force them to do it without those incentives. And yet, owners, once again, proving they're the cheapest people in the world, they're all billionaires. We've got multi-million dollar payrolls. But when you talk about safety or technology, man, there is nobody cheaper.
That's actually a really good idea. That's that has some potential to, I think, in my opinion, work out really well for teams and players. A couple factors in there involved are, you know, the players that they probably want training at certain people that they recommend don't necessarily need that money. And then, you know, with what's kind of the whole deal with minor leaguers right now, and you know we know what the some of the foundations helping out minor leaguers, trying to get them, you know, better pay, better resources and whatnot. Yeah. And, you know, I'm involved or helping out with some of those organizations. The actual owners aren't necessarily doing much for them. They don't really have a say. Mm-hmm. So that might be maybe the issue on that end, as far as, like, you know, the guys that aren't 40 man, getting that training.
Absolutely. I mean, you would want everybody, I would think. I mean, maybe there's players you don't care about, or players that are going someplace. If you got a Corey Kluber going to Cressy, then you probably don't really care. Let him go. You'll feel pretty comfortable with that. But the trying to get people to do something, yeah, it's not going to be a one size fits all number. But, you know, if you really want Mike Trout to do something you want, it might cost you $1 million. But holy cow, if it's not worth $1 million, do you really want it that bad?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, is you can show them all the reports necessary that they're going to save money if this guy's training in a way that's going to keep him healthy. But you know, that only goes as far as the paper does. So that's sometimes hard to really show and to prove. I mean, I got a good story, a buddy of mine, he's a trainer. I'm not going to name the team, but he was on his previous team he was on. They I want to say saved like, man, it was like 50 or 60 million in a year.
I know this story.
And they brought it to the team, said, hey, our medical staff have saved you guys an enormous amount of money. And they basically just poo-pooed it and kept their budget low on the medical side and just acted like it was no big deal. And it's like, no, if you take care of your resources and you understand how to train and how to deal with the medical side of things, that you're going to have a superior result. But that's, you know, you're also talking to you know, GMs that don't necessarily know that side of it. They just see what's on paper and what the numbers are. That's it. And then they have to assume that it's going to continue one way or the other, or that it was by chance. And it's like, you just can't teach them.
Yeah. Chance isn't a decade. Yeah. One of the things that I've always done, whether it's with baseball or football, is 1 year is luck. You can have a good year. You can have a bad year. Especially in baseball, where if you get two Tommy Johns, your year is shot in terms of days lost, because you just lost two guys for essentially the entire season and maybe part of next. In football, it's a little less, but there you have to look at value. If you lose, you know, your backup punter, no big deal. If you lose Andrew Luck for a season, pretty big deal. I think when you look at 3, 5, 10-year numbers, that's where luck stops happening. When the Colts have been 30th or worse for the last 12 years, save for 1 year where they were 18th, that you might have an issue. You know, if you had the 31st best offense in the NFL for 2 years, you're going to have a new offensive coordinator. If you're losing the 31st most days in the NFL, I would hope you would have a new medical staff, but at least in the Colts case, it's not. I may know the team you're talking about. There was a team that was among the top three in baseball, brought them exactly what their results were, and they cut their budget. And a few years later, they have a new athletic trainer, and their results went phenomenally down. On the other hand, gosh, I want to say it was 2011. When I was at Sports Illustrated, I did an article about how much money the medical staff of the White Sox had saved over the last decade. And it ended up being like one of those punch cards at Subway, where if you buy 9, you get the 10th free. They had saved enough money at that point that their average payroll over the years, they essentially got 1 year out of the decade out of just the savings. And I had two different high-ranking people in the organization call me to check my numbers. And they're like, are you serious? And I was like, yeah, why are you asking? He's like, because Herm Schneider is going to be up here showing me this article as soon as it hits his mailbox. So I want to be able to answer it. But it was true. And you know, there were several teams that were almost as good. And of course, the White Sox, one of the best organizations in terms of health around still to this day, a decade later.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating. I know they have a lot on their plate. There's a lot of things they have to balance here, but this seems like a pretty important one.
It does, but here's the other thing about that. You know, health is one of the things that a general manager should understand. And if he doesn't, I don't mean he should be a doctor. I don't mean he should be digging down deep in the numbers. But, you know, most general managers these days didn't play baseball. But they still understand how the game works and what batting average is and slugging and you know all the other technologies and things that go into baseball. If you don't understand the health aspect or why this number is good or bad, or if you just don't understand why it's bad that you got four pitchers out for the year with Tommy John, there's plenty of people you can ask. Start with your staff, and then there's a lot of people around like you and me that they could ask, and some do and a lot don't. And those are the ones that we see getting replaced in the off season.
It's definitely not a coincidence when you see organizations that are doing really well on the both strength and the rehab side, and they have very progressive, smart, outgoing individuals running those programs that reach out to other people for advice, for thoughts, ideas, and then you have the subclass where everything is very, very tight knit, but it's also a little bit behind in the times. You know, you have people that aren't trying to progress and get better. And like, you know, I'm not shocked when I see, you know, the reports on, you know, the top ranked performance or medical staffs. And, you know, these particular organizations are always bottom third. Like, and it's consistent. You know, and again,
you can say Mets.
I was thinking more NL East teams, but the problem is, like, or not the problem, but the other obvious side of this is quite often the records of the teams coincide with what their staffs look like.
Yes and no. I mean, there are times where you'll see teams, Boston a couple of years ago when they won the World Series, had a number of injuries. But part of that was that they were willing to take on some players that were a little bit broken. David Price comes to mind. You know, he missed a good part of that season, but he was effective when he was out there. So it's tough to credit a team as easy as it is to debit them. Because, you know, if David Price misses 100 days of the season, I don't know what the actual number was, you can easily take that off. But, you know, had he been with another team, would he have missed more? That's one we don't know. There's a lot of ways to try to do it, but none of them that I'm terribly comfortable with. I think there are teams that take on a lot of risk and end up with what looks like a lot of days and time lost, but it's really kind of factored into it. And that's one of the things, it's theoretically unknowable from the outside, though it's usually pretty apparent, and I can usually call somebody and figure it out. So I think it doesn't always correlate with record. Where I think it's difficult is when a team is trying to innovate. You know, if Eric Cressy, who was just hired by the Yankees this offseason to monitor their strength and conditioning, if all of a sudden they have a bunch of injuries over the next couple of years, they're not going to renew him, and they're going to blame him. And, you know, I think Eric would take that on, but it's not going to be entirely that. He doesn't have full control of these guys, there are a lot of ways to suss out what it actually was, but innovation is the thing that often gets stepped on with record rather than, you know, those broader categories like days lost.
I think you also kind of brought up another good topic or point in that with the GMs not really appreciating or understanding is a lot of injury is not predictive. You have to, there's an awful lot of chance involved. And if someone has a freak injury and it's not an overuse injury, it still goes in under an injury.
Yeah.
And, you know, time lost is all still the same. So you can have these crazy occurrences where there was nothing anybody could do to stop that. And yet it's all still counted the same. So
exactly. You know, I've always tried to figure out a way from the outside to take the injuries you couldn't prevent. You know, the one that always comes to mind is Mike Cameron. I can't remember who he ran into. Was it Beltran? Horrible collision. I can't remember who the other guy was, but Cameron got the worst of it. Yeah, no, nobody can stop that. Yeah, other than, you know, the two outfielders missing each other, the guys running into walls, you know, a guy sliding and injuring himself. Who was the guy that got taken out and broke his leg during the playoffs a couple of years ago? Those kind of things nobody can prevent. On the other side, we would have said the same kind of thing about hamstring strains, which I think are going to be a big deal this year. We know hamstring strains are preventable. So, you know, how many major league teams are out there doing Nordic series during the off season? The answer, very, very few, which is just dumbfounding to me. You know, how do you count that? Is that preventable, not preventable? The other one is the ones that you would think would count as preventable would be problematic. If I take, say, oh, here's a great example. Kerry Wood. Kerry Wood had Tommy John surgery just after his great 20 strikeout performance. But it wasn't that they overused him there. They did. But you know, there's the famous story of him throwing both sides of a 9-inning doubleheader on the same day in the Texas high school tournament after the Cubs had drafted him. and so I think that high school coach deserves at least some of the blame / credit. So if the analogy about Tommy John surgery being like smoking, you know, you don't get lung cancer the first time you take a puff, it builds over time. It's tough to, especially at the major league level, who may have had that guy for 3 months and then the elbow pops, and it was everything else that guy had done through his minor league, college, high school, little league career that had led to it. They're going to take the blame for the next 12 to 14 months.
I think that's a very fair point, because a lot of the newer research coming out now is saying that a majority of your damage seen and done later in your career is due to that, you know, the throwing between the ages of like 12 and 18, you know, your little league to high school career, and then into college potentially, is what's doing you in. So if, you know, if you pick somebody, if you're training somebody, you're working with somebody, and they've already basically written their whole script out based off of what their, you know, previous experience was, you can't necessarily, well, I shouldn't say that. It's not that you can't stop it. It's going to be a tough road to hoe. It's going to be a hard one to deal with, because you're at that point, you're kind of damaged goods, and no one wants to hear that, but it's the truth. So that makes, I guess, the argument on, you know, working with individuals. You know, you hear players talk about, oh, I worked with this guy and he screwed me up and then I got worse. And you can't blame that person. You know, context is everything. And if that athlete was already coming in, in bad shape, or, you know, they had a strand left on their rotator cuff or their UCL before it was about to pop, you basically just, you know, you were asking for trouble, and that was the person that unfortunately had to deal with it. So,
And we're seeing, it's interesting. This Monday, I talked to a Major League Baseball scouting director, and he was like, "Hey, you know, obviously the draft is going to be weird this year. What do you think of this guy?" And gave me the name of a college pitcher, and I was like, "Well, he's got this, this, and this. He had Tommy John surgery when he was in high school." He's like, "We don't care about that." I was like, "Hold on. Do you care if anybody had Tommy John surgery?" And he's like, "No, it's pretty much known. I care if it happened in the last year." And I was like, I paused and I was like, okay. And I think that's a pretty universal thing. That said, you know, there's a high predictability from past injuries, and a guy who's already broken is more likely to break down. I'm not saying he can't go on and have a good career, because obviously that's the case. But here's an interesting one just to Tommy John surgery. I'll put you on the spot here, Tyler. There are two people in the Hall of Fame who have had Tommy John surgery. Do you know who they are?
Off the top of my head, I'm going to say John Smoltz.
That's one.
And I'm not going to be able to get the other one. Is it a position player?
It is.
Oh, man. I'm not going to be able to get it off the top of my head.
It's Paul Molitor.
Oh, I wouldn't have got that.
He was a third baseman, blew out his elbow, became one of the great DHs of all time. But that said, there is one pitcher with Tommy John surgery. No, Mariano Rivera didn't have it. He had elbow surgery. They were worried they were going to have to replace it. Turns out his UCL was fine. He just had some bone spurs and a little bit of scarring. But think about that. You know, Tommy John surgery has been around, you know, 35 something years now. Really, you know, 20 years of consistent usage. And yet one. Think of all the great pitchers that have had it. Does having Tommy John surgery essentially remove enough of your career that you won't hit those big numbers? Now, I know those numbers are resetting, but think about, you know, some of the great pitchers today. You know, the guys who we talk about as potential Hall of Famers, Clayton Kershaw, CeCe Sabathia, just recently retired, didn't have Tommy John surgery. On the other hand, you look at guys like Strasburg. You take a look at, I'm just running down a list here of, you can almost say there's more guys who have had Tommy John surgery than haven't. But if you can think of one guy who has Tommy John surgery and is on track to be a Hall of Famer, I'd be interested because I can't name any of them. Now, I do think Hall of Fame is going to be really weird for pitchers because nobody's going to have 300 wins. Nobody's going to have 3,000 strikeouts, most likely. Maybe Scherzer. It's just really strange that Tommy John surgery, which fixes you, gets you back in a year, essentially wipes out the Hall of Fame.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. I do think as we're trending towards this direction that we're going to see way more TJ, post-TJ players in the Hall of Fame. But you're right. I think it's going to have to be the guys that got it in college or high school. You know, you think of like a DeGrom, he already had it coming in and he might hurt himself again. He might have something else happen, but I guess that gives him the highest opportunity to get the most, most in, if you will. But you bring up a good point.
Yeah. But again, let's go through. If you're talking about active players who have had Tommy John surgery that are on track for the Hall of Fame, DeGrom's a good one, but that's a guy who has 60, 70 wins career. I'm trying to go down a list of, in my mind, if it would, Chris Sale, who has had it now, he's only got 100 something wins. I think it's 110, something like that. And he's, gosh, I can't even think how old Sale is. It feels like he's been around forever. He's probably 31, 32.
That sounds right.
Yeah, Adam Wainwright is probably the guy who you'd think of. But on the other side, the two guys, or three, that I think are probably Hall of Fame pitchers right now are Verlander, who has been very healthy through his career.
Mm-hmm.
Kershaw, who has been not very healthy, but has managed to get through it. And Max Scherzer, who has been, he had some injury issues at the start of his career, but nothing major. And those are the three guys who come to mind for me. If there's one other guy that really pops out to me as a Hall of Fame pitcher, it's John Lester. But I'm just not sure if John... I look at John Lester and I was like, if I was a Hall of Fame voter, where would he be? There are guys who are not in the Hall of Fame, like Curt Schilling, who are significantly better in my mind than John Lester. And there are guys, Lester to me is like the modern day Mike Mussina, a guy who was always good, but never great. Yeah. And Mussina had a couple great seasons. Don't get me wrong. I just don't think we've got that many Hall of Fame pitchers right now. We've got great pitchers, mind you, but we're going to have to change the standards. Did I lose you, Tyler?
Oh, there we go. I did the same thing. Lost the mute. As you were saying, I'm looking up the Hall of Fame leaderboard on Baseball Reference, and it shows, the pitcher's not yet eligible, and it basically ranked off everyone you just said from, Verlander, Kershaw, and Scherzer. I think you're right. We're gonna have to change what the standard is based off of decent numbers, or maybe we call wins above replacement the big number, or it's perceived career dominance. I don't know. I mean, you made a good point about Schilling. Schilling's numbers are absolutely Hall of Fame worthy. But again, his outside of baseball
Shouldn't count. Shouldn't count.
It
at all.
Shouldn't count, but I think that's what's holding him back.
Yes and no. I think he's on the edge. For me, he's over the edge and over the edge enough that I would vote for him right now. Then again, the top of my vote would not look like very many people. I would have Bonds in giant John Hancock letters. I would have Clemens just under that. I don't think you can tell the story of baseball without those two.
Can we make an argument that they're the best players of all time at their position, at hitting and pitching?
Yes. Yeah, I actually did a newsletter a couple weeks ago. There's all these stupid games going around on social media, but one of them I can't remember who it was that put it out there. It was like, who are the best players in your lifetime? So I went back and just looked at the WAR for them and said, okay, from my birth date forward, who was it? And yeah, if I was wondering whether there would be a difference between the guy I think it should be and the guy it actually is. I knew Ryan Sandberg wasn't going to be the best second baseman, but I would pick him, 100 times out of 100 just because he was my favorite player growing up. But there was no question Bonds was the guy. And I was curious whether it'd be Clemens or Maddux. It's Clemens by a little bit. And I don't think you could argue that at all. But yeah, it's pretty amazing that just in our lifetimes, we've seen probably 4 of the top 10 pitchers of all time in Clemens, Maddux, Johnson, and Martinez. You can't argue. If you can argue those 4 aren't among the top 10 ever, you're crazy. You're absolutely crazy.
I agree. And it's insane that they're all played in the same time. You know, it's maybe it's a coincidence they all played. Well, yeah. I know. Maybe it's a coincidence they all played in the steroid era. But I mean, to put up those numbers against, these juiced up hitters is insane to think about. Now, I would have a hard time saying buying that someone like
there were as many juiced up pitchers as there were juiced up hitters.
Yeah, well, yes, and that's kind of what I was leaning towards. But guys like Randy Johnson or Maddux, I would have a hard time believing that they were taking something that at least to the extent that these other athletes were doing to keep that competitive advantage. But I could be wrong. I don't know.
Next question.
Yeah. I want to get to know more about you a little bit. I mean, we've talked a lot on baseball and current landscape, but you've had a pretty awesome career working as a writer. You've been a part of Baseball Prospectus, Sports Illustrated. You've done stuff that's been on ESPN, worked at Bleacher Report for a while. FanDuel, Modus. You worked Modus last couple of years. Where are you at now? What's going on now with you?
Yeah, I'm nowhere. I'm doing my own thing. And I wanted to get back into writing. With Modus, it was a great opportunity. I loved working there when it was sold. I didn't move on. Driveline bought Modus. They chose to go a different direction, and that's fine. They've got a great team over there. The last thing they needed was me. So it gave me an opportunity to step back and say, what do I want to do? And I want to write. I want to go back to what I was doing and trying to help people understand the injuries and to tell the stories of sports through injuries. And oftentimes, the stories of the people behind the injuries, the athletic trainers, the doctors, the physical therapists, all the people around the injuries, because nobody tells their story. So getting back to that, and I'm doing a newsletter. It's free until opening day, whenever that is. Picked the greatest time to launch something, didn't I? Oh, if you want to sign up for that, again, it's free until opening day. It's at undertheknife.substack.com. I've just been doing crazy stuff. My last column, I broke down the mechanics of Bob Feller and Walter Johnson, which we don't have all the modern tools on those guys. We've got bad, grainy video, including one that I thought was fun, where they argued that Bob Feller threw 120 miles an hour. I don't believe that's the case. but hey, I don't have Aroldis Chapman out there trying to throw faster than a speeding motorcycle either.
True. No, I will vouch for your newsletter. It's definitely worth the time, worth the read. It's actually really awesome. It's a good, fun little read. It's not too overwhelming to where, with today's time where if it's more than so many characters, people don't even look at it. It's a really good read, and we'll link that up in the show notes for sure. But I would highly recommend anyone to go at the very least check it out.
So that's the one thing I'm doing. The other is I'm coaching at the Division II level at the University of Indianapolis. I'm kind of a pitching coach, kind of a consultant, kind of a little bit of everything. I've worked with them when I was at MOTUS and their coach Al Reddy and their pitching coach Landon Hutchison, two absolutely great guys, along with Trevor Ford. They gave me the chance to come in and be a part of the team this year, and things were going great. We had a bunch of great pitchers. We were 12-3 through the start of the season before things were called off. We were doing some really innovative things. We were preventing injuries. We were managing workloads. And so I won't give everything away because we're going to do it again next year. And luckily, we're going to have most of the same players back. The seniors given a chance to come back. And so we're going to have a lot of baseball players with MBAs, apparently.
Yeah, that's going to be a huge mess. I don't even want to begin to think about the whole transfer or the lack of a draft or just all the stuff going on right now with eligibility.
We're lucky. At the Division II level, the NCAA handled it right and gave all the seniors an extra year if they wanted it. And that was the question is, you know, a lot of our guys are going to graduate and go on to have jobs. And you know, most of our guys are not going to go on and play baseball anymore. Doesn't mean they're bad players. Far from it. It's just the reality of the situation. So the fact that we're going to get a significant number of our guys back is great for them because I would have hated to have them wonder for the rest of their life what might have happened. Now we're at least going to, hopefully next year, go out and get to play an entire season and grab a ring. And so that's been a really fun thing for me, getting back into the coaching side of it.
What are you able to take into your experience into that role? Like, you know, from all of your experience working in Major League Baseball and talking to all, you know, some of the top people in the game, in the history of the game, as far as strength and conditioning and rehab goes, like, what are you able to take to the team with those experiences?
It's been reinvigorating for me because you do have to take those lessons and translate them into terms these kids understand. Remember, these are kids that are between 18 to 22, 23. I can remember one of the early days we had a guy who stepped across his body and I go, you know, good pitch, but you don't want to end up like Kerry Wood. And he just kind of gave me a look and I was like, oh God, he doesn't know Kerry Wood. So you do have to. There was another time I was like, we got to get you a Nolan Ryan kick for a kid who was, I was trying to get him to get a higher leg kick, you know, really low kick. He had always been slow to the plate. So he was almost a slide step all the time and he didn't need to be. And I was like, we got to get you a Nolan Ryan kick. And he knew who Nolan Ryan was, but he didn't have that vision in his head because he'd never really seen him play of, you know, he was a high leg kick. He knew of Nolan Ryan more as a tall tail, you know, it was kind of like I think of Walter Johnson for most people. You know what he did, but could you see his motion? Hardly, unless you, you know, go and frame capture Ken Burns. So it's one of those things where I've had to reconfigure how I give information and the modern context of velocity over everything. Is interesting, and being able to use tools like Rapsodo for pitch design and MOTUS for workload management and some of the machine learning that I've been doing to try to model out how you could get a player through the season and which pitchers should be coming in. Those are technologies we just haven't had, and we especially haven't had at this level. So it's intriguing to see how well they were working.
That's wild. No, that's it. I had the same realization. I teach a class at Maryville University here in St. Louis. And I made a reference.
We were going to play them.
Yeah, you got. Yeah, I think that was we were going to meet up, but that didn't turn out. Obviously, I made a reference in class. It was a Tommy Boy reference, and I got a bunch of blank stares. And I go, wait, has no one in here seen Tommy Boy? Like, I felt like that. That was almost like a rite of passage. Like you had to. That was something you had to watch.
I had the same thing. I made a Rocky Horror Picture Show reference and just got blank stares. And then I was like, okay, I get that these kids haven't gone to midnight showing of Rocky Horror, but they had like no cultural knowledge that it existed. And I couldn't figure out when that stopped. I mean, it was always a goofy, bad movie, but it was the experience of it. But now I can't figure out when that stopped. And I've actually been going back, going, when did these Midnight Show, when did we switch to Tommy Boy? Things like that. It's that, where are the cultural cutoffs, and how did I miss when that happened?
It's almost like you have to like take an entire decade and shift up one. And then start at 2000, like the year 2000. Okay, now they know references. So it's not that you have to throw it out. It's just that it's basically worthless to them.
Yeah.
So we've talked a little bit about what you have going on now and past experiences. I want to know, was there any event or experience in your life that massively influenced who you've become today? Like, was there, you have a unique skill set in writing with about sports injuries and a vast knowledge of it. Was there something that triggered this?
No, not really. It wasn't one single event. It was more an accumulation of being able to learn something and translate it and keep doing it. I always tell people, I am not the most talented writer. I'm certainly not a medical professional, but I came back every single day and I'm going to give you something every single day that's a little bit better than before. I've actually got the third column I ever wrote and it doesn't look significantly different. So maybe my writing hasn't gotten any better, but I know so much more 20 years down the line. The experience of it. That said, one of the things I learned early on is that you're always getting new people. When I explain why, what's going on with Mike Trout's ankle sprain, God forbid, it might be the first time that person ever had an ankle sprain really explained to them. So I can't just skip ahead. I can't assume they read a column from a year ago. I've got to go through it again. And I can't get frustrated that, oh my God, I've got to explain the damn ankle sprain again. What's the difference between a sprain and a strain? The only thing that frustrates me is the sprain is a tear thing.
That's like your calling card, right?
Yeah, I've got t-shirts. I've talked about putting those back out. It's not broken. It's just fractured. We get a lot of those. And those will happen. Sprain and strain doesn't bother me. When people screw those up because, it's one letter, it doesn't really make a big difference. So if you tell me you've got a strained elbow, and I still see national sports writers doing that, that'll happen. That one doesn't bother me. But when you say, oh, it's just a sprain, it's not torn. Oh my God, that one sets me off. But you have to go back and you have to understand that, I think it was Willie Mays. It was some great player saying, that kid in the stands, it might be the only time he gets to see Willie Mays, so I better play today. That's kind of the case. Yeah, I'm certainly no Willie Mays, but if I got to explain an ankle sprain 20 times in a season, that's part of the job description.
Yeah. Hey, so did you go to journalism school?
God, no. I wish I did.
No.
No, so all of that was a lesson in learning, on the job. There were mistakes I made early in my career because I didn't have that kind of knowledge. And so learned it the hard way. Don't criticize people. Don't be a jerk. And I was a jerk far too much in my early columns. Don't be a know-it-all. And I was a know-it-all far too early in my columns. Don't get a big head because you'll get knocked down. That'll happen a lot. And just simple things like, you've got to have a copy of the documents, learning how to source things out. There were things early in my career that I could have done a lot better and it would have made my life a lot easier, but you learn those along the way.
I think, a lot of the experts in the field learn through the school of hard knocks, right? There's so much you can't teach in school that you need to know. I would say a majority, maybe not a majority, a huge number of what I do and know right now was not taught in school. It was going out, learning, getting your hands dirty, experiencing different subsets of people. It's nothing is ever by the book. That is the truest statement I've ever been told in my life, and it has always been that way. Nothing is ever cut and dry by the book.
Nobody ever tells you that Buck Showalter doesn't have a sense of humor, so don't make a joke in a press conference. I've made that mistake once. So there are things like that that are always going to happen. There are things that absolutely nothing can prepare you for. John Rocker grabbing you in a locker room and you know, saying, "Why did you say my elbows hurt?" I said, "I, you know." Those kind of things, crazy.
And you go, because your elbows hurt.
No, I never said your elbow was hurt. I said it was sore.
That's funny. I want to riff off that a little bit. What are some of the more memorable moments you've had in your career? I mean, you've been all over the place.
Ooh. Yeah, I've gotten to cover such great things. I mean, going to All-Star games and World Series games and Super Bowls. NBA finals, you name it, I've covered it. I've gotten to meet great people on or off the field. A couple of years ago, I was on a panel and it was Neil Eletrosh, one of the top surgeons in the world, Scott Boras, the top agent in baseball. Like I had to explain that, Oral Hershiser and me. And I was just sitting there going, yeah, one of these things is not like the other.
What am I doing here?
And you know, it was crazy. And then it's funny because Oral Hershiser, at the end of his career, had shoulder surgery, came back from it, pitched pretty well, but was never quite the same. He and I are one of very few that Frank Jobe did where it's basically called the Hershiser shoulder, and it's not done anymore because it's not terribly effective. Sitting there with Oral Hershiser, we were sitting there comparing scars and pitching stories. And there was a moment where I realized Oral Hershiser is listening to me telling a pitching story and then giving a pitching story of his own, like we're peers. And I was just like, no, this is weird. So, you know, there are crazy little highlights. All sorts of, you know, I can remember the first time I heard Peter Gammons talk about my column on the radio, and I very literally almost drove into a telephone pole. So, you know, every time I see him, I just want to hand him money. I wouldn't have a career without Peter. little things like that. The friendships you make, the memories you have, there are so many great ones. You remember the crazy ones, like there was a player who didn't want to talk about his surgery. I won't name the future Hall of Famer, but you know, didn't want to talk about his surgery. I asked him a question about a scar, and there was a moment there where I thought I was going to die because he was much, much bigger than me and was holding a bat. And luckily, I survived to tell the tale. But there was that brief moment where I was like, "Oh crap, this is not going to go well for me."
Yeah, that's one that you remember for the wrong reasons. That's not, No, but I mean, that's the fun stuff right there. Like I've been in a few of those scenarios where I'm sitting at a table having conversations with people going, I don't belong here. Like, this is stupid.
Yeah. Well, I think imposter syndrome is for everybody.
It's
but,
true.
You know, there's a lot of times where, you know, I'll call doctors. My favorite one, fairly early in my career, a team doctor called me and he thought I was a doctor. You know, from my right, people all the time, they're like, "Are you a doctor?" No, I'm very clearly not a doctor. I've never said I'm a doctor. I'm not a medical professional, that right up front. But I guess he thought I was. And he starts saying, "Hey, can I get your opinion on this?" And starts reading out the case to me. And I was like, "Hey, I'm not a doctor." And I mean, he was looking for a second opinion. I was like, "You know, I'm not a doctor." And he's like, "Really?" Pauses for a second and then just continues. And I was like, okay, I guess that's some form of compliment. I hope he really didn't take my advice. But
I'll pause you on that real quick. I do think that's valuable. So if you take a surgeon's perspective, they know the ins and outs of the elbow, the shoulder, whatever. They know the body really well. They know the techniques really well. They know how they need to rehab. They know the process of the healing. like the back of their hand, right? But what they don't understand sometimes is the mechanical side of things. What led to this? What they're seeing? What the trends are? What's gonna happen with this person's mechanics or their arm, you know, as they get back to return to play? And that's the type of thing that, you know, like, that's valuable. They don't grasp that. So I don't think that's, it does sound crazy to you, like, from that perspective, yeah. But like, I, just talking with some of these individuals, like on a, you know, peer-to-peer basis, this isn't crazy at all. Like, that is a very valuable skill set to have, or knowledge to have, that I think, it's maybe not a normal thing, but I think it should, it should be more commonplace.
Yeah. It's a treatment, but no, you should not call me for a second opinion.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not a medical opinion per se, but some advice on how to approach the situation. Is it's not medical advice per se, you know? It could be.
This one was.
Okay.
This one, he thought I was a doctor, called, which was flattering, but yeah.
That's pretty good. I love that. Has that happened since?
No, not like that. There have been times where, you know, agents will call me and saying, yeah, what should we do in this case? Who should I send them to? So I've kind of been a surgical Sherpa sometimes. There have been players that I've walked through the whole process. There have been players I've gone to surgery with them and their family. There's a great amount of trust in those. There's situations like that where I'm kind of guiding people. Those are the ones I hate. Are where I'll get an email or a call and it's like a parent, and he'll be like, well, my son is, his elbow sore. And I was like, why? Well, he's 12. What should he do? There was one a couple of years ago. This one stands out to me. It was a 12-year-old kid, and he was on 3 different travel teams. And the coaches didn't know. So the parent just, he was doing the best for the kid. He didn't want to tell the kid no, but he was starting 3 games a week and throwing, you know, 20, 21 innings in a week, and that wondered why his elbow was sore a month into the season. You know, the parent had the best of intentions, but the worst of information. And yeah, there was a lot of wanting to throttle the parent, but then again, the system failed him as much as the parent did.
That's a tough scenario. I've had one personally where I had a 12-year-old coming to see me. They were driving 3.5 hours twice a week to see me, and it was their 12-year-old was a American top 100 for, yeah, whatever.
Why are there ratings for 12-year-olds? I
don't know. Like, you haven't grown at all. You have no maturation at all. So he obviously was playing on 100 different teams. You know, this is the shortstop, the kid that hits bombs, the most athletic one.
Plus showcases.
Yes. And, he had Little League, shoulder. So, you know, a growth plate issue where those happen from repetitive overuse and, you know, overdoing stress at that joint or at that growth plate. So it's hard that, you know, from their perspective, they have this once in a lifetime athlete for a kid, and they want to give them everything possible, but yet they don't know that what they're doing is yeah, harming him per se. And then the coaches, they don't speak. They don't, you know, you have one kid that he's, or one team that's like a all Missouri team, and you have one that's an all region. They don't talk. They
that
don't
was know. Exactly the situation. And I get angry at the parents, but I get angrier at the system. I can remember talking to Glenn Fleissig, probably the top biomechanist in the world down in ASMI. And when they came out with the Little League pitch guidelines, I was like, this is a great idea, but it's going to backfire. It's going to push more kids into travel ball because the kids that are good enough aren't going to want the pitch restrictions. They're going to want to showcase themselves. And that's exactly what happened.
It's exactly what happened.
Damn shame.
Yep. No, that is... to a T, what happened?
No fault of Glenn's. You know, Glenn's great, and they were doing what was right. It was the unintended consequences of doing the right thing. I used to get angry with parents, but it's a systemic problem, and I don't, unfortunately, know a way to fix it.
The hard part about what happened was they put that together for a certain subset of athlete, in like the Little League programs. But what happens is everyone that just plays Little League is now subject to that. But the people that they put that in place for, like you said, they fled. They went to a system that they can kind of skirt it and get around it. And it's basically now not being used at all by the people that it's meant for.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of the things. You just got to shrug your shoulders and say, you know, Jim Andrews is going to make a boat payment this month because some 12-year-old needs to be on a travel team.
Oh, man. And the fact that they're doing TJ surgeries on as young as 13 is still insane to me.
I just heard about a 10-year-old.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I can remember there was – I won't name the surgeon here, but he had done one on a kid who was 12 just after the Little League World Series. And he was just like struggling with it. He was like, did I do the right thing? You know, we hadn't done it on kids that young for a lot of reasons. First, you know, how do they grow? Is there going to be a problem with it? Turns out there wasn't. The kid's in his 20s now and pitched all the way through college. Never had another problem. Wasn't great, but I mean, he never had a real problem. But you could feel the angst in his voice after he called me. But now, yeah, it's as low as 10 that I've heard of.
Man, that's tough. And here's the shitty part about it. If it's torn, it's torn, right?
I mean, see, that's the thing. That's what it comes down to is Tommy John surgery is not an elective surgery. You have a specific injury, and it has a specific repair and a specific rehab. We've always heard these stories about, should my son just go ahead and have Tommy John? No. Is his ulnar collateral ligament damaged? Is his ulnar collateral ligament ruptured? If no, then no. There is no surgeon out there that is going to do an elective Tommy John surgery. I know people have said elective surgeries with Sale, and this whole COVID crisis and Syndergaard, totally different thing. Luckily, as far as I know, there has never been a surgeon so unethical that he would, you know, do Tommy John surgery on somebody just for the billing. And I would have heard about it. So the parents that asked this, again, the system has failed them. They need to be educated. We need a better parent and coaching education system for baseball. Football at least has tried to put it in over the last 2 years. I don't think it was a great system. It hasn't made any difference, but they at least tried. Baseball has to do something.
I agree. I don't have that answer. I don't know what it is.
I would start with licensing. I think all coaches that are going to coach at any level, no matter what it is, and I think there should be a state thing, is you have to have some form of education. And I am talking minimal level stuff. I'm talking stuff you can do at home. As an NCAA coach, you have to go through, I think it's 6 hours of courses about recruiting and sexual assault and reporting and things like this. And you can do it all online. Look, if you just gave general first aid, general coaching tips, general strategy, how to organize a practice. Soccer, something I've gotten into during my career through consulting with English and Spanish teams. I've learned more about that. But they have licenses that you have to like work your way up. You start with a I forget what the system is. It's like a national license. And then there's like ABC levels, and then there's a continental license, and then there's a pro level license. And so if you see, you know, a Jurgen Klopp or a Jose Mourinho or one of those, they've got this, you know, top level license. Why doesn't baseball have that? I mean, show that you're experienced, show that you know the basics. There are classes and tests in the soccer system, and they're difficult. Guys fail it. I can remember a team I was consulting with, one of the guys was like, hey, I've got to skip the meeting because I've got a test coming up in a month that I've got to study for. I failed it once. If I fail it again, I lose my job. And I was like, oh, crazy. We should have that. I mean, even at a basic level for Little League guys with simple things, just give them enough tools to do better. And then, you know, as you move up, there should be tons of licenses. And there are great organizations out there. ABCA does a great job. Some high school systems do a good job. The NCAA at least has some basics, but they could do a lot more. So I think we do need some sort of licensing system for coaches.
It's a good, real good thought.
And we need athletic trainers at every youth sport. That's the other one.
That would be, I think that is should be a must, even if it's on some form of like hospital volunteer basis, like something.
Absolutely. I think if you can afford sports, you should be able to afford an athletic trainer. Because, A, they're not that expensive. I would be willing to say if you were taking a college kid who was an apprentice, you know, going out there, he needs hours, she needs hours, since 50% of the NATA students are female now, I would be willing to go with that. Because those kids at least have some training. They know when they're in over their heads. Especially because, you know, like youth football, you're dealing with concussions. That's not that difficult. So an athletic trainer could deal with that and say, you know, this kid needs to sit out. This kid needs to go to the hospital to be checked out by a doctor. Those kind of things. That wouldn't be that difficult. Same with baseball. I mean, most of what you're dealing with there is, you know, kid got hit by a pitch, kid twisted an ankle, kid ran into something. But in those situations, I think it's just amazing that we don't have that. I think it's better than half of all high schools don't have an athletic trainer. You know, colleges at least are required to have an athletic trainer at practices, but you don't always get that. It's crazy.
So it sounds like you're, just from some of the previous things we've talked about, you would like to get back into doing some more of the like in clubhouse type work. Is that, am I picking that up or no?
Clubhouse stuff I don't like. One of the things I get criticized on, either, why aren't you in the clubhouse? Well, first off, they didn't give me a credential. So that's one. The Colts have never once credentialed me. People always ask why I criticize the Colts and then don't show up in the locker room, because I can't. So that's that one. I would go. If some national organization wanted to pay me to go, absolutely. It's not like I avoid it. But what I do doesn't really need it. As long as I've got a phone and an internet connection, I can do this. And I think a lot more people are like that. I do think you lose something in the case of not being able to be there and talk to people and develop those relationships. But 90% of my stuff, it's not like I can walk in to a doctor or a player is going to tell me everything that's going on in the training room. And the athletic trainers are obviously precluded by law from telling me on the record. So it's one of those things where, if somebody showed up tomorrow and said, hey, we're going to give you a national job, I'd certainly consider it. But that said, I think really the future of sports writing is going to be on a more individual level. I think newsletters like what Joe Sheehan and Joe Posnanski have done and what I'm doing now are really going to be the future. I want to be able to control my relationship. I want to be able to have a more direct relationship. I don't remember who said this, though Lady Gaga has kind of taken it up. All you need is 1,000 real fans. If I had, I don't even need 1,000, but if you give me 1,000 subscribers who are helping fund my work, I'll be taking lots of trips to clubhouses. I'll be doing whatever I can to get them the best information. And I think, especially with the further legalization of sports gambling, injuries are going to be the one asymmetric advantage.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I got a few more questions I want to hit. I know you got a hard out here in a few minutes. So you've written 2 books. Tell me about that process.
Crazy ones. My first book, Saving the Pitcher, was me learning how to do it. It was trying to distill a lot of information. I used information from Tom House, who has been a big influence on my career. Funny story, Mark Pryor was the model for the book. He was like, we've got a bunch of drills where it's showing pictures of him doing them. Like when he was long tossing with his high school kid. And you know, when it was going to paperback, Mark was injured. So we were saying, hey, do we want to have a whole bunch of pictures of the injured pitcher? but the kid had just been drafted. And so we were like, hey, maybe we have some pictures of that high school kid who's now in the Phillies organization. But we had no pictures of Cole Hamels.
Oh, man.
So the process of writing Saving the Pitcher was, you know, how do you write something that long form? How do you make it interesting? How do you make it, you know, relevant? I was trying to give up. It was basically when a parent came up to me and said, what should I do for a pitcher to make him the best possible? This is what I wanted to hand him. And it just wasn't out there. There were a lot of pitching books out there. There were a lot of instructional books, but they tended to be more, you know, Tom House had written a couple books, but they were very specific. You almost had to be a pitching coach to really get them. And his best one had been with Nolan Ryan in the late 80s. So there had been about a decade gap. And that's huge because now it's kind of funny. Some of the coaches on at UIndy read Saving the Pitcher. I'm like, no, that's from 2003. None of that works now. We've learned so much since then that people that tell me, hey, I bought your book. I was like, why? Why would you do this? Thank you. I get, you know, a penny from that, I think. But it just doesn't hold up. We've learned so much. You'd have to rewrite the book every year. On the other hand, the juice was from the time I made the agreement to the time it hit the newsstands or bookstores, whatever it was. We had bookstores back then, was 10 weeks. So that was a process of just flying through stuff. I didn't write all of it. Jay Jaffe wrote one of the best chapters in the book about, you know, trying to statistically look at how everything went together. I had some doctors that wrote chapters on how the testing worked. And then the same day that book came out, Jose Canseco put out his book, Juiced.
Oh, no.
And they had very similar titles.
Oh, man.
But it was one of that said, the juice does hold up. The things I said about, you know, amphetamines being more serious or that, you know, a lot of things we saw coming down the line of almost genetic level doping, those did. But the two books, yeah, they certainly weren't Stephen King level bestsellers, but they're to see your book on a newsstand somewhere. I remember seeing The Juice at the airport, you know, the little bookstores they have there. That was pretty special, and I'm proud of those books.
That's a really cool moment. What was the hardest part of writing a book in general?
Turning it in. you know, one, in terms of deadline, you know, most books you have years and then it takes years to turn them around. And it's tough with The Juice. It was so quick, but it was the fact of being done. And I think this is the same way with a column. You know, I always want to change something. I always think I can do a little bit better. I iterate a lot, even when working with pitchers. I just want to fix a small thing, and then I want to fix another small thing, and I want to fix another small thing. I'm never going to make big changes to somebody because I don't think they work. Big changes are hard. Small changes are easy, but you can build those up. You know, you can stack 100 pennies pretty high. So the hardest part for me was being done with a book. Hmm. Saying, you know, it was never going to be perfect, but this was good enough.
All right, I got a couple heavy hitters here.
All right.
So what's a common thought or perception that you believe that others would think you're crazy for believing?
Mine is that you know, change is nearly impossible. Big changes. People just don't change. If you tell somebody to lose weight, that's too big. If you tell somebody to alter their eating habits, that's pretty big. If you start making small changes, and start making habits, those are where you can do it. In baseball, it's the same way. You've got to make small, small changes. And the smaller the change, the better. Because, man, if you're going to change somebody's arm action, you're gonna screw them up. Because they've been practicing that arm action for 5, 10, 15 years when they get to the pros. For me, it's all about small changes. I don't believe any big change. Usually it isn't possible, but it's almost never the right decision.
Yeah. Okay. Where do you see the industry going? Where's baseball going? You were reporting through Moneyball, through the analytic rise. Yeah. Where we're at now through technology. Where are we going to be in 10 years?
It's great. You know, one of my, actually my first intern, Chaim Bloom, is now the general manager of the Red Sox. Yeah, there have been some changes over the last 20 years. Chaim would have, man, that kid, his resume glowed. It's like he spoke classical Greek. He sang a cappella. He did all these different things. It was like, why do you want to be in baseball? Shouldn't you be like running the world? And God, I wish he was. Red Sox are so lucky. There's been changes. I just don't think baseball is a game that changes significantly. I mean, baseball changes at a glacial pace. So I think what we're going to see are again, small changes. People talking about playing baseball in a bubble, I just don't think it works. I don't think that's what people want. I think we're going to get back to normal life much quicker than people expect, or really that's even safe, but I think it's going to happen. So I don't think baseball is going to change significantly. I think we're going to see small changes. I think, you know, we're going to see some unintended consequences. The consequence of analytics is that baseball is significantly better. The players throw harder, throw better, throw sliders that nobody can hit. And yet here comes Aaron Judge, who hits it a mile and a half. We're going to see more injuries because these players are wound tighter. Ferraris need fixed more often than Fords. So I think we're going to see an evolution of baseball. But at the same time, you know, none of the analytics guys who taught us how to make baseball better anticipated that the product would be boring. You know, it's a game of strikeouts and home runs now. And as much as I like strikeouts and home runs, the product of the game is pretty unwatchable at times. So I think we're going to have to figure that out. I think baseball is uniquely positioned. If virtual reality ever happens, baseball is the one that can take place there, because I think the game is more set up for it. Just think about video games. You know, if you're standing alone in your living room, you could be Roger Clemens. Most people have a big enough space to pitch. You could be Aaron Judge. Most people could swim. I think golf might be set up for it almost as well as baseball, though it's certainly not as exciting. Football, you can never get hit. You can never tackle somebody in your living room if they figure that out. That
would be wild.
Yeah. Hockey, basketball, it's just not the same. Baseball, I think, is uniquely set up for that. So if we can make baseball more watchable, more fast-paced, more action, then I think there's certainly possibilities. That said, you know, the whole extra innings, somebody on second base thing is goofy. Pitch clocks are stupid and are going to result in more injuries. We've got to sit down and figure out how to make this better. The other thing that may be a little more timely is I'm curious why anybody goes to the ballpark. There is something to it, but 99% of the time, my big screen 4K TV and pause button is a whole lot better way to watch the game. For me, it's a social experience going to games. I want to go with my friends. I want to experience it. I want to have a beer. But I think we need to figure out ways, you know, can we make it more immersive? Can we make it a better experience? If you're ever lucky enough to sit courtside in an NBA game, you're absolutely ruined for the experience. And now we're at a stage where everybody could. If you've dealt with an Oculus, basketball works in VR because I can sit courtside. Baseball's got to figure that out, and they got to figure it out in a hurry.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's wrap this up. I got one more. What changes do you think we'll see in sports post COVID-19?
I don't think we're going to see any. I'm going to be pessimistic on this. I think we're going to open up faster than people think. I think we're going to see a second wave of illness. And I don't think we're going to have the kind of national patience to stay quarantined long. And I think there are far too many people willing to sacrifice another 20,000 to keep the economy going. Rightly or wrongly, I don't pretend to know. I'm not going to be on any Reopen America commission. I don't think it's going to change. I think it should. I think, you know, we should have, I don't think we need, and this isn't just because I'm a Tampa fan, I don't think we need as many seats. I certainly don't think we need as many suites. Again, I think a virtual experience could be just as good if you could sell the same seat 10 times over to somebody who's watching at home virtually and give them the same experience. I think we've got to figure that out. So I think smaller stadiums with better experiences are the wave of the future. But that's intriguing because that means we got to build more stadiums. And, you know, I don't know how much public willingness there is to do that. I mean, Texas is about to open a new stadium, and, you know, if I get down there, that'll be the third stadium I've sat in in about a quarter mile of distance there in Arlington, Texas. I watched Nolan Ryan pitch there. I can remember watching World Series games there, and now we're over here, and at least we've got a roof in the new one. But I'll be intrigued. The thing that surprises me is the NFL didn't figure this out first, and they're building, you know, a massive stadium in Los Angeles. They're building a pretty big stadium. It looks like the Death Star in Vegas. Yeah. I think they need the bigger crowds, even though they have the TV money. I think baseball's going to need smaller stadiums, like 25,000 max, and a whole lot of ways to make it more of a television game.
Yeah, I think at the very least we're going to see more security measures, like everyone getting thermal scan just to make sure you don't have a crazy raging fever or anything. You know, just the imminent.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, you know, we have that in terms of security. You know, you got to walk through the metal detector. I remember, funny story, going in, I'm trying to remember what year it would have been, but in Cincinnati, it was the year that Cincinnati and San Francisco were in the first round of the playoffs. San Francisco ended up coming back and beating them. But I was walking in, waiting for the security line. It was one thing for all the press and VIPs. And the guy in front of me, I wasn't paying a lot of attention. He was talking to somebody, taller, older, black gentleman. And as he got up to the line, they asked for his ID. And he realized he didn't have it on him. And that's when I realized it was Frank Robinson. And the guy next to him goes, "It's Frank Robinson." And the poor security guard is just doing his job. He's like, "I need his ID."
Oh, no.
And there were like five of us standing there going, no, you should let the guy in the Hall of Fame through. That's Frank Robinson. We'll vouch for it. And he ended up getting through. But it was just an absolutely hilarious moment. But, yeah, I think we're going to end up with a lot of, you know, security theater where, you know, somebody's going to figure out kind of a temperature detector the same way we have a metal detector now. Somebody's going to dig through your bag to make sure you took your medicine. Who knows what there's going to be, but I don't think there's going to be significant changes.
Yeah. I think the same thing happened to Chipper Jones this year at the new spring training facility, right? Did you hear about that?
No, but
he didn't have his ID, and he's basically like, my face is all over the walls. Like,
yeah, that's me. Chipper's older players are kind of funny because, you know, Frank Robinson, you know, I think upper level, and certainly chipper in an Atlanta context. The thing that's funny to me is that baseball players, even among guys who are really good, look like normal guys for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, Mike Trout is a big guy, but he's not like an NFL big guy. Pretty close, though. But if he's walking down the street, you just think, that's a tall guy. There are a lot of people who probably wouldn't recognize Mike Trout. There are, that's one thing. There are probably a good 75% of Major League Baseball players, if they don't have a hat and a uniform number on, I couldn't tell you who they were.
Yep.
Yeah, there are guys I see who, you know, just when they don't have their hat on, think about how many players in your career, you don't know what their hair looks like.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. Oh, man. All right, Will. Well, let's land this plane. What, you got anything to plug? Anything else you want to promote?
Yeah. If anybody wants to read my stuff, again, undertheknife.substack.com. It'll be a daily newsletter once things start up, and it's going to be free until opening day, whenever that is. So you can do that again, undertheknife.substack.com.
Yes, please hop on that, and I will put I'll list that in the show notes, and I highly recommend it as well. So, well, Will, that was awesome. That was a really good conversation. Thanks for everything, and stay safe.
Hey, definitely. Thanks a lot, Tyler.
Take care. And that wraps it up with Will. Hope you enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good conversation. I've always admired Will's work. Please go check out his newsletter, Under the Knife. You don't want to miss out on this. It's actually a really good, well-written newsletter. Very entertaining. So don't miss out. Go subscribe. Check it out. Reach out to Will via email. You can check him out on all the socials let him know what you think. Thanks for listening. To purchase the World Pitching Congress Digital Experience. If you're an athletic trainer, chiropractor, physical therapist, strength coach, or pitching coach, this is your way to sharpen your skills and stay on top of the game.